Ragtime to Rock and Roll. In part 14, Stuff to Give the Troops, Kenneth Moore examines the war years, finds out what happened when songwriters went patriotic, when musicians joined up, when American musicians came over here, and when a song became a double agent. With help from many voices, he recalls the Blackout, the V-Disc, the American Forces Network, and a band leader who became a major.
When war finally broke out in Europe in 1939, even the complacent British public was, to some extent, prepared for it. Prepared for the idea of it, that is, but not for what it would be like. Conscription and the gas mask suggested that this time, one way or another, we were all going to be enrolled among the troops. The air raid warning, a fluctuating or warbling signal of varying pitch, as they said on the posters, that went off not long after Mr. Chamberlain had gone through the ritual of declaring war, only seemed to confirm the idea. Labelled like peacetime holiday luggage, children had already been sent away from the big cities to escape the Holocaust. But when the British continued to wake up in the mornings to find themselves neither gassed in their beds nor being shouted at in German, they began to realise that life was going to go on, even perhaps under a veneer of normality. The London headquarters of Tin Pan Alley reacted swiftly. Long used to being the nation's emotional wholesalers, the songmakers prided themselves on their ability to judge a prevailing mood. In the first days and weeks of wartime, songwriters had bright ideas, to paraphrase James Thurber, the way other people had mice. It's tempting to suspect them of commerce aforethought, but the production of this stuff was, after all, their job. There was Kiss Me Goodnight, Sergeant Major, Berlin or Bust, and a whole arsenal of vocal missiles aimed at Hitler himself. Nasty Uncle Adolf, Even Hitler Had a Mother, and Tommy Handley with a song called A Very Little Nazi.
We've been trying hard to polish up our Hitler by struggling through that turgid book, Mein Kampf. We have waded through his views on encirclement and Jews till our brows with perspiration are quite damp. For we are told to know our enemies, a motto which the prudent soldier always bears in mind. But we'd feel a little surer that we really knew our Führer if the answer to these problems we could find. So, does Adolf wear pajamas or a nightshirt? Does he take his teeth out when he goes to bed? Is that unruly lock of hair a detachable affair, which he hangs up on the bedpost overhead? He looks so big and fierce in all his war paint, but when once he's hung his raincoat on the door and removed that awful tunic that cost 50 bob in Munich, there's a very little Nazi in the raw.
Tommy Handley with a wittier-than-average anti-Adolf number. Well, there was certainly plenty of ingenuity about, and for a second generation of soldiers on their way to France, someone thoughtfully provided, if a grey-haired lady says, how's your father, it's Mademoiselle from Armentières. And there was this.
All right, you whippets, get the move on and fall in loudly. Come on. Company! Now, me lads, we're moving into action. Don't look too happy about it. It ain't no picnic. Wipe those grins off your faces. Pigs, banners! Move to the right in pause. Form, pose.
Hey, Bert.
How do, lad?
Where did he say we were going?
Well, young sergeant says we're going to have a cup of tea with Adolf.
You don't say.
Huh?
Yeah, I say, Bert.
What's to do now?
What's that big wall over there?
Is that the Essex Green Line? Used to belong to Delamess, I know.
Are we supposed to take it?
Aye, dead easy.
What are we going to do with it when we've got it?
I could tell thee what to do here, but this is what we're going to do.
We're going to hang out the washing on the Siegfried Line. Have you any dirty washing, Mother dear? We're going to hang out the washing on the Siegfried Line, cause the washing day is here. Well, the weather may be wet or fine, we'll just romp along without a care. We're gonna hang out the washing on the Siegfried Line, if the Siegfried Line's still there.
Well, it's easy enough, I suppose, 35 years later, to be smug and say what a ridiculous song that was. But whatever else popular music is supposed to do, it's no part of its job to predict military history. In any case, to know all is to forgive all. Here's the composer, Jimmy Kennedy.
My troop, Royal Artillery, wanted me to write them a troop song when we were called out. We were territorials. And I thought, oh dear, what do I do? And then one day I looked at a paper, and there was a cartoon series running in this paper by a man called St. John Irwin, and about a soldier called Young Bert, who was with the BEF in France, writing to his mother. And he said, dear mother, all I can send you is the Siegfried Line. You must hang your washing on it. And I thought, this is it, hang out the washing on the Siegfried Line. So I had a piece of manuscript in my gas mask, which I shouldn't have had, and I dotted down the chorus. And I thought no more of it, sang it to the chaps, and we rather liked it. And then one day Michael Carr came down, and he said, look, have you got any ideas? I said, no, I'm much too busy in this army business. And he said, oh, I haven't a thought in my head. I said, well, you're not in the army, I am, so the onus is on you to get somebody. I tell you, I said, the only thing I've written since we've been called up has been this thing, and I sang him the chorus of Hang Out the Washing On. He said, gosh, he said, that's another Tipperary. So I completed the little manuscript I had of the chorus and gave it to him. So he went up and wrote the verses. I think he wrote the verses on the train going down to Bristol, because he took it to John Watt at the BBC. They had moved to Bristol at this time. And John put it on the air that night. And the next day, it was the hit of the year.
That song used the old device of the letter to home from the man at the front. The songwriters, meanwhile, actually found a new topic in civilian life. Tripped over it, almost.
When we go strolling in the park at night, all the darkness is a boon.
Who cares if we're without a light, they can't black out the moon.
I see you smiling in the cigarette glow, though the picture fades too soon.
But I see all I want to know, they can't black out the moon.
If, for a special minority, the blackout had certain advantages, for most British civilians, physically speaking, it was the worst thing about the whole early part of the war. In a classic David Langdon cartoon, one just discernible figure is saying to another, well, Granny, this is the blackout, like it? But it's an ill wind that blows all the lights out. And the record companies spent a few very happy weeks running large advertisements in the daily papers. Bright hours with records to chase away the gloom of dark nights, one of them ran. The gloom of their own dark night was being dispelled too, for the 30s had been a tough time for the record industry. Now the demand was suddenly back. Another record company advert showed a young soldier sitting by a wind-up portable gramophone and writing a letter. Dear Mum, the Sarge says, send us Adolf on Decker, he'll know what to do with him. All rather coy, I suppose, but plainly suggesting that we were to send Fragile 78 through the post to France. And this was available.
Who's taking you home tonight? after the dance is through. Who's going to hold you tight and whisper, I love you, I do? Who's the lucky boy that's going your way to kiss you goodnight at your doorway? Who's taking you home tonight? Darling, it's plain to see I'm pleading, please let it be me.
Later on, Vera Lynn was to become more or less one of the munitions of war herself. But for the moment, we'll concentrate on the songwriters. In spite of all those magnificent titles of the early war days, the songwriters' war effort was sometimes more apparent than real. Even the record we began with, Wish Me Luck As You Wave Me Goodbye, came from 1938. It was a peacetime song that got conscripted. A later number, one of the biggest British hits of the whole war, which I'd have sworn was written with travel warrants and kit bags in mind, not only wasn't composed deliberately as a war song, it wasn't even the work of full-time songwriters. Lovely Weekend was the joint creation of Ted and Moira Heath.
Well, it was really written as a joke. I wrote the poem after a weekend Ted and I spent together, which was unusual for us because we never had a weekend together, although we'd been married for years. And we just happened to have this wonderful weekend. And so I wrote a little thank you poem, saying thank you for it, and tied it up with blue ribbon, put it on his pillow, which was ridiculous. And he came home and read it and rolled around laughing, thought it was terribly funny. And that was that. And then it really, a little time afterwards, you know, I think Ted said, you know, that would make a very good song, you know, if we alter it just a little and take out the bits that were unpublishable and make it into a song. We had piano part put to it and he took it round to the publishers. It was just completely rejected.
In fact, the only way Ted Heath could get it played on the air, oh, he was a trombonist with Gerardo at the time, not the future Prime Minister, the only way was to pay for the arrangement himself. As it turned out, he got a very good return on his £8 investment.
I haven't said thanks for that lovely weekend. Those 2 days of heaven you helped me to spend. The thrill of your tears as you stepped off the train. The smile in your eyes like the sun after rain. To mark the occasion, we went out to dine. Remember the laughter, the music, the wine. That drive in the taxi when midnight had flown. Then breakfast next morning, just we two alone. You had to go, the time was so short. We both have so much to say. Your kit to be packed, the train to be caught. Pardon me for crying, but I just felt that way. And now you have gone, dear, this letter I pen. My heart travels with you till we meet again. Keep smiling, my darling, and someday we'll spend a lifetime as sweet as that lovely weekend.
Lovely Weekend, and earlier, Who's Taking You Home Tonight? Two slow and rather wistful songs, and there were, or soon would be, plenty more of them from both sides of the Atlantic. I'll Walk Alone, Room 504, I'll Be Seeing You. In the Second World War, an old principle about music and morale was asserting itself more strongly than ever.
I discovered when I was out there that the real thing that was therapeutic and helpful were the slow, sad songs. They liked to think about the slow, sad songs. It made them sad temporarily, but immediately they felt better for it. I don't understand why, but that's perhaps just a psychological reason.
That was Joyce Grenfell, but it might have been almost any wartime entertainer who took songs to the troops. The authorities don't seem to have interfered with the sort of material being written and sung. They appear to leave it to the writer's patriotic and commercial instincts. They weren't unconscious, though, of the relationship between song, propaganda, and morale. They took one wartime song very seriously indeed, and a German one.
Stand eine Laterne und steht sie noch davor. So wollen wir uns da wiedersehen. Bei der Laterne wollen wir stehen. Wie einst Lili Marleen. Wie einst Lili Marleen.
Lili Marleen. And became a classic illustration of the ancient precept, if you can't beat 'em, join 'em. The song was naturalized British, more or less at gunpoint. And the man who performed the ceremony was lyric writer Tommy Connor.
Well, there'd be much propaganda by the Germans with this song, and particularly in the desert. Night and day, the loudspeakers were trained on the British trenches and encampments, blaring out Lili Marleen, and this German girl evidently had romantic sound or feel about it, and all the Tommies started singing this German lyric. And the authorities said, this will not do, our boy singing a German song. So we promptly captured the song. Having brought it to London, where the publishers were given the rights to publish it, subject to it having a good lyric, we were okay by Mr. Churchill, General Eisenhower, and the lot, because they said this will be counter-propaganda if we get the right lyric. And two or three other well-known songwriters had been called in to do the job and unfortunately had fallen down simply because they'd modeled their lyric on the German lyric, which was not a nice lyric. It was a charming lyric, no doubt, to the Germans, who were told by the lady singing the song that she was prepared to make the greatest sacrifice herself for the sake of those who were about to go and die for the fatherland. But I couldn't do that kind of lyric to Lili Marleen. So I then imagined the song, well, it might be about my daughter, my wife, my sweetheart, my sister, my dearest relation. And I thought, as a soldier, I would like to hear that kind of lyric. I was then stumped, and I didn't know what to do, because I was confused with the many versions I had been told about, and I wanted to get this right because it was to be ready by the next morning. And so I swiftly said a little prayer. And as swiftly came the answer, I started to write. And with a half an hour, the lyric, now known as Lili Marleen, my version, was presented to my publisher the next day, and it was published, and thank God it became the hit it did.
Underneath the lantern by the barricade, darling, I remember the way you used to wait. Was there that you whispered tenderly that you loved me? You'd always be my lily of the lamplight, my own. Sailing somewhere over there, all confined to barracks was more than I could bear. I knew you were waiting in the street. I heard your feet, but could not meet my lily of the lamplight, my
Now, there was an instance of direct intervention by the War Office concerning what kind of stuff should be given to the troops, an uncharacteristically positive move. In fact, they weren't very positive about anything to do with entertainment. Even the chief purveyor of entertainment to the services, by appointment, as it were, began its work unofficially. It was a body called ENSA, Entertainment National Services Association, and it was started by a few individuals from the profession, the chief of whom was Basil Dean.
I felt the need of something to raise the general morale of troops and to keep their eyes on the ball, so to speak. I got three of my friends, I think it was, to a meeting at Leslie Henson's house in St. John's Wood. They were Leslie Henson, Owen Nares, Godfrey Turl, and myself. There was the four of us. And we decided that we would appeal to all branches of the entertainment industry to come in and form a committee and organize an entertainment for the troops. And it was because of my experience in the First World War that I jumped in before the Second World War was declared and went to Nappy and said, let's do the same thing on a bigger scale that I did for you in the First World War. And they agreed, which was very far-sighted of them. And then later, of course, became the Treasury, and then we had the orchestras, and the thing grew and grew and grew until it was the largest entertainment service the world has ever seen. And I hope it never sees another.
It was only under the auspices of Ensor that entertainers could be sent to France in the early part of the war. One of the first band leaders to go over was Gerald Loss, with a specially assembled show.
I remember having to see Jack Hilton those days. Jack had something to do with the war services. And Jack said to me, I just heard a boy audition, and I think he's got a great future. Great talker, and his gags are very subtle, pretty clean, and I think he's a boy for you, particularly for the troops. Why not try him out? He said, his gag line is, wheel him in, wheel him in. I said, who is he? He said, Charlie Chester. So Charlie really started off with me. He came out there, then there was Jack and Eddie Eden, which was a dumb piano act, something like the Western Brothers, and the Carlisle Cousins were quite a well-known singing group, rather attractive, lovely girls, harmony group. There was Chick Henderson, late Chick Henderson, there was Monty Ray, and some others. So all in all, we really had a great show, and it was geared to do anything after about a three-hour show.
Time Joe Loss, with appropriately enough, let the people sing. And Basil Dean was in a position to know what they liked to sing.
They liked down-to-earth entertainment, you see. They liked the simple things. They were haunting songs, perhaps a good word. Rather like Lily Marlena, that sort of thing. They liked the broad humour, of course, but it was the melodies and the enchantment of suggested home, possibly, I don't know.
Sally, Sally, don't ever wander away from the alley.
There was quite a degree of criticism that those very characteristic choruses of the First World War didn't evoke similar songs in the Second War. There was a notable lack. And I think it possibly was because the romance of war had disappeared. Its horrors and bombardments and so forth were such that the men didn't march romantically into strife, so to speak.
Basil Dean. As well as answer, there was yet another method of supplying troop entertainment, uniquely British in its haphazard mixing of pure chance, semi-official encouragement, and musicians' natural guile. At its humblest stage, it simply drew on whatever talent there might be within the camp or district. A 1939 Fougas cartoon has an officer saying into a telephone, "I'll swap our second piano tuner for one of your six comedians if you'll give me a written guarantee that he isn't a female impersonator." Out of a not very different process came a band like this. Sound of the Squadronaires, one of the most famous of the service dance bands. Its original nucleus came from the Ambrose Orchestra. A key man was trombonist and comic George Chisholm.
We suddenly sort of got together and said, "Well, look, it's going to be a few weeks before they say, come in, you're in." And we decided, not through bravery, I'm sure, to volunteer at the RAF, which we did. People like Jock Cummings, Tommy McQuaid, Archie Craig, Annie McDevitt, Sid Coleman. And six of us went up like idiots and said, "Here we are, we are the band, you see." And they said, "The what?" Anyway, we got in, you see, with the idea of perhaps somewhere along the line trying to form some sort of a band. And well, we went to a place called Uxbridge. It was what was called a parent station. You got there and for a few weeks or so you were there, just sort of sweeping floors and cleaning lavatories. And we did this for some weeks. In the meantime, in the evenings, we used to just sit and have a little blow, and people started to hear this, you see, and it strayed into the office of the officer commanding, and he said, "Splendid. Why don't we play at the officer's mess this Friday? We've got a little thing. And by this and other things spreading, we suddenly thought, well, it would be nicer to get a bigger band if possible. And consequently, we got access to the incoming names, and we thought, we'd find somebody who plays a certain instrument, perhaps we could grab hold of them and not have them sent away too far. And by, you know, careful watching these things, we got 14 fellas, which were then called the Squadronaires. We were sent out to various things, and the distances got further and further. But this name, funnily enough, Squadronaires, was suddenly seen by an Air Council official, and they objected most strongly to this name. It's got to be by permission of the Air Council, it's got to be called His Majesty's Royal Air Force Dance Orchestra. If you like, in small print, the Squadronaires. But the further away we got from Uxbridge, the bigger the name Squadronaires got, the smaller the other, by permission of the Air Council. And we got this band, and they said, they thought, well, perhaps a morale booster might also jolly up the troops. Consequently, they were sent to France and Germany and Holland and what have you, and we did all the entertainment there.
Thank you.
system, or lack of it, which brought the Squadronaires into existence also created other bands, like the Skyrockets, conducted by Paul Fennelly, and the RAOC Blue Rockets, all to be adopted officially. Thus, the basic principle was tacitly established that entertainment, and especially popular music, came very close behind food, ammunition, and uniforms in the needs of a nation at war. One of the most prolific providers, of course, was the BBC.
A letter from home to the forces, from Vera Lynn and Fred Hartley. Our men in uniform, from the girls at home. A personal letter in words and music, and the signature is Sincerely Yours, Vera Lynn, with Fred Hartley and his music, presented by Howard Thomas.
The ideal thing, I thought, was a letter from home. This is a girl in England thinking of these men and perhaps uniting them and their wives with song. The line that I took with Vera Lynn was that she said in her letter from home, "This isn't just me singing to you. I'm the bridge between you and that girl back home. That this song, you remember when you heard it sung in a cafe or at a film? And all the mail which we got, which was 1,000 letters a week, was chosen not from the usual fans, but from people thanking her. Captains of ships, far off air units, saying, 'Thank you, Miss Lynn, for uniting us, my wife and I, felt together because we heard you were singing our song.'"
I'm sending my letter to Santa Claus. My letter I hope he'll receive. Oh, I wonder if he will please remember me when he calls on Christmas Eve. He'll get a lot of letters for playthings from other girls and boys, but I want my soldier daddy. He's better than all the toys, and so I'm sending my letter to Santa Claus to bring Daddy safely home to me.
The Vera Lynn programs, which began in late 1941, established once and for all the truth of the remark Noel Card had made a decade earlier in Private Lives about the potency of cheap music. Almost exactly a month after the first of those Vera Lynn broadcasts, the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor, and the United States was surprised to find itself at war. This meant that American Tin Pan Alley went to war also. How it responded, and who wrote what, we hear from American songwriter Johnny Mercer.
Well, in the Second World War, it seems to me that Berlin took charge of that just like he did the First World War. He had most of the songs about the war. He had a big show about the war. He had two shows. I think one was an Army show and one was an Air Force show. And what was left over, I think, Frank Lesser had. There are a lot of songs that were written at the request of the government. I wrote a song called the G.I. Jive, which came out of a show called the G.I. Journal, which was a radio show which was beamed at the armed forces. Then a lot of us, everybody in the movies, went and did a show called Command Performance, which is exactly what it sounded like. If you were asked to do it, you did it. And we played a lot of camps. I did a lot of movie shows, movies, I should say, which were connected with the war, like Star Spangled Rhythm, Here Come Waves, Captains of the Clouds. They were all service shows, and they were all had WACs and GIs in them. And some songs came out of there. I wrote a lot of songs that could have happened, but never did happen. I wrote a song called Old Glory. I wrote a funny song called He Loved Me Till the All Clear Came. I'm Doing It for Defense, on the Swing Shift. Didn't mean a thing. But I don't think there was any really great big song out of this second war like there was out of the first war. I don't think people believed in wars anymore. I don't think they believe in propaganda either. A really big song, in my estimation, for the wartime is Don't Sit Under the Apple Tree with Anyone Else But Me. That's a huge hit song. Kids also love to sing it to their girls. I mean, you know, what is a song? It's like a greeting card, you know. It's something that you're putting words in a very shy fella's mouth. Doesn't know what to say to his girl anyway. So give him something to sing. Something to say when they're dancing. And that's what a hit song is.
Fairly obvious from what Johnny Mercer was saying that when the Americans entered the war, they mobilized their forces of entertainment more thoroughly and on a far larger scale than we did. There was even an official body known as the American Theater Wing War Music Committee, which tried to decide on behalf of the Americans what kind of songs they should be hearing. All very laudable, of course, but to quote one observer, what happened? Nothing. Nobody has yet been able to lead the nation to the musical trough and make them drink. When the public found a song it did like, it drank deeply enough. This is songwriter Sammy Kahn.
The most incredible song was I'll Walk Alone. This song went on to become one of the most potent war songs. I had fan mail from all over the world saying I could only tell my husband how much I missed him by sending him this song. Or soldiers saying, I can only tell my wife how much I missed her by singing this song. And one of my favorite mementos of the entire war and the song is this picture of a bunch of GIs parading down a road past a farmhouse wall on which is printed, I'll Walk Cologne, C-O-L-O-G-N-E.
I'll walk alone, because to tell you the truth, I'll be lonely. I don't mind being lonely when my heart tells me you are lonely too. I'll walk alone. They'll ask me why, and I'll tell them I'd rather. There are dreams I must gather, dreams we fashion the night you held me tight. I'll always be near you wherever you are each night. In every place, if you call, I hear you, no matter how far, just close your eyes. And I'll be there. Please walk alone and send your love and your kisses to guide me. Till you're walking beside me, I'll walk.
I'll walk alone, as Sammy Kahn proudly recalled. Well, I suppose what it boils down to is that in wartime, just as in peacetime, some songwriters got lucky and rich, some didn't. The public, in uniform and out, continued to soak up American musical entertainment as it had done for years. Everybody heard the Andrews Sisters and the Inkspots and the Glenn Miller Band on records. Soon, America's idea of what to give the troops was to have a greater effect on popular music in Britain than anything since the arrival here in 1919 of the original Dixieland Jazz Band. And for the same reason, American popular music was coming here in the flesh. Not immediately, though. In the beginning, were the American Forces Network and the V-Disc. This is Johnny Vrosis, who, as Johnny V, worked as a DJ on some of the earliest AFN broadcasts. He remembers how AFN started.
That stemmed from a meeting between General George Marshall and General Eisenhower. And it began on the air in dear old London at Carlos Place on July 4th, 1943. It was devised to inform and educate and entertain the American serviceman in Europe and bring home closer to him while he was in combat in Europe. We did a little of each, probably more entertaining. Because with entertaining, you get the folks to listen. And with the entertainment as the backbone, or sort of a backbone, the other aspects of it fell into place. We had small transmitters scattered throughout England. When we first began, we had five. And they had a small listening radius of perhaps 15 miles. But we did have a number of Britishers who listened. We could tell from the fan mail that came in.
As the transmitters became more numerous and more powerful, so more and more American-style radio was available to any Briton who cared to eavesdrop. Anyone who was of impressionable age during the war will remember its unfamiliar, racy, slightly contraband sound, as brought to us intentionally or otherwise by AFN. It was Britain's first direct exposure to the American way of broadcasting. And not even the BBC could contain its curiosity for long.
After we'd been on the air for about 2 or 3 months into our...